We've all done it. Stock our fridge with leafy greens and good intentions, only to have our future self sacrifice quality nutrition for the convenience of takeout. Keep your body and mind nourished all day with a whole body meal shake from Ka'Chava. It's got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. But the best part? It actually tastes delicious. With 6 indulgent flavors to choose from, it's easy to make a superfood packed shake. From chocolate, vanilla, and chai, to matcha, coconut acai, and strawberry, you've got endless ways to personalize your Ka'Chava. Whether you prefer it straight up or enjoy adding fruit, peanut butter, nut milk, or even iced coffee, with every 2 scoops of Ka'Chava, you're getting 85 plus superfoods, nutrients, and plant-based ingredients. Shop now through December 2nd to get 30% off your first purchase of 2 or more bags with code NEWS at Ka'Chava.com. That's 30% off for a limited time at kachava.com, code NEWS.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise of Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the host and the founder of the Rise of Justice Movement and the Rise of Justice Movement, the podcast. Today, I will give a very broad viewer discretion is advised due to the nature of the topics that we'll be discussing, not only limited to police brutality. Today, I am joined by Vanessa. Vanessa, welcome to the Rise of Justice Movement podcast.
Hi, Zach. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. It's an absolute honor to sit down and talk to you, which this episode has been a while in the works, and there's been a lot happened since the last time we talked, so I'm excited to dive into that. But feel free to introduce yourself to the audience and walk us through your journey, and we're all ears. We're here to listen.
My name is Vanessa Perez. I'm the mother of Joseph Perez. Joseph was beaten by the Sheriff's Department July 27, 2020 in the city of Industry. After the beating, Joseph was taken to the hospital for approximately 4 hours and then took into the county jail.
Which this is another, you know, oftentimes we hear about like system inequities, systematic racism. We hear about system inequities. And this is another case directly of that. And walk us through, you know, who Joseph is, who he was before this happened. And walk us through kind of like what led up to that a bit.
Joseph's always been a sensitive, soft-spoken child. He did struggle mentally at the age of 12. He was hit by a car. His head broke the windshield. And from that point on, he suffered with mental health. At the age of 18, we called the pet team, like normally, like we would normally do. And this time they came with the sheriffs, and they had said that Joseph was an adult child now, and him refusing to take medication and there being 2 minors in the home, Joseph would need to be not in the home anymore. And that I would need to, that his mental status is like too much, I guess, for to have minors in the home. And according to them, that's neglect on my behalf because I'm the mom, and I'm having an adult child not taking medication is neglect on my behalf and putting my 2 daughters in danger. So Joseph became homeless, and the girls were removed from my home. It took about 6 months to get my girls back into the home. And at that time, Joseph, obviously being on the street and suffering mentally, had more issues than him being homeless on top of his mental status. He became worse.
And it's another example of instead of addressing mental health, we address criminalization. And, you know, I admire you obviously, I'm not a parent. I'm not. I have my own experiences with the criminal justice system, juvenile justice system. I was placed on probation for 5.5 years for an assault charge that I did not actually commit. And luckily, I did not have to go into like the juvenile, go further into like juvie or like juvenile detention. But I did many hours of community service. And then again, I was on probation for 5.5 years, which obviously, growing up being a smart ass teenager, it was not the easiest thing in the world for me to do. And I had to walk like that straight and narrow, and they made an example out of me directly. And I went to the youth court where I faced my own peers, people that are literally my age or maybe a little bit older. And the quote unquote judge at that point was very detrimental towards me. It was very judgmental. I think my mom remembers this too. It was a debilitating experience for me. And I supposedly had somebody who, they connect you to, that's also another peer that is supposed to represent you. But he just kind of like looked at me, looked at the judge, and said, "Yep, he did it." I was like, okay. It's like, I really hope you do not become an actual attorney because you can't just say that. So now, don't get me wrong, I do respect the youth court. I understand they do a lot of like work. I understand that. But my experience specifically, it was not good. They made an example directly out of me. So walk us through how you found out that this was happening to Joseph. You mentioned a lot about, and you told me quite a bit, and you've done some other interviews where, you see or you heard like things kind of like happening. But walk us through what led you to walking to where Joseph was, and like that specific instance.
At that, you're talking about the beating, right?
Yes.
Okay, so about a week and a half prior to the beating, Joseph was in crisis, and the Cerritos Hospital, Cerritos College Hospital, they had called and they had said, "We have your son. He's been here for about 3 days. He attempted to light himself on fire. West Covina, I believe it was, transported him here, and this is where he's been. And visiting wasn't until I want to say about 2 days later, and he didn't. Joseph, I guess, wasn't in the right state of mind to give me a call or anything, so." I waited for the visiting, and the day of visiting, they had said Joseph checked out of the hospital. That he, when you're 18, and if you're already done the 72 hours, you're able to say you're good to go, right? So that's what he did. And I want to say, I believe he was on day five there. I can't be exact, but I want to say day five. And I stood around here looking for him because there was no phone. He didn't have a phone to call. And Cerritos Hospital is like by the beach area, like maybe 45 minutes away from where I live. So I knew he wouldn't just get here like in an hour if he was walking or taking a bus or, you know what I mean? Just anyone in that state of mind isn't going to get here at a normal time. So I didn't find him. I didn't find him. And Friday, July 25th, I still hadn't found him. And I went ahead and called the hospitals this way and nothing. Then I decided to call the jails. So I called City of Industry and they had him. They said that, he was there. And I said, look at. I explained to them what had happened about, what I just explained to you. And they said, well, he's going to stay where he's at. And I said, look, listen, like my son suffers with mental illness. It's like rapidly like deteriorating. I don't, I, he checked himself out of the hospital too quick. Can you put him on a 5150 hold, or can I, pick him up and take him to the hospital? Can you meet me there? Like any type of like option, like, can you help me? And they said no. He's gonna stay where he's at. So now they kept him for 24 hours. So now it's the 26th, right? And that evening, and they released him. And they released him that night, and he was maybe about 2 blocks away from my house. And I had got a phone call saying that Joseph was nearby. Because since Joseph was homeless, a lot of the homeless people, I knew them, right? Because like if Joseph was there with them, I'd feed them as well. And so they called, and they said, "Hey, we see Joseph. He's crying. He's talking to himself. He's walking towards your house." So immediately I got in my car, and it was about 2 in the morning. And I went searching for him around here, and I couldn't find him. And I would see like the sheriffs, and some like they were driving fast. They weren't together. Like it would be like a single car. And but they were like driving fast in different directions. But I did see like maybe about 6 of them just in that short time of looking for Joseph. I couldn't pinpoint where they were at, because if there was a siren, it would quickly go off, and they had no lights. And so I couldn't find them. And I live like close to train tracks, so I will try to stick by there, because like the normal person would think to walk from the station towards the train tracks, and then it would be like my house, right? But I guess Joseph didn't take that route. He went like literally like in between like streets and like the residential area. So when I couldn't find him and I couldn't find the cops, I came to where I live, and I live in a gated community. So there's a door, like a gate, where he would have to come in. It would only make sense for him to come into this entrance where it's a walk-in entrance. So I parked there and I waited to see maybe he'd walk up. And he never did. And soon, like within minutes, a helicopter came. And the helicopter was very close to us, very close to the floor. And he had his bright light on, and something, I guess, inside of me said, I need to follow the helicopter. So I turned around, and the helicopter took me directly to the scene, which was about like I want to say like two blocks away from me. Driving, like it was quick to get there, but walking, like it's like a maze kind of. And when I got to the scene, I want to say there was about 30, maybe 30 cop cars. There was SUVs, there was cop cars, there was like the old school ones. They were with no lights, and they took up pretty much that whole street where I had to park like way down. And the fire department was there, and they had lights. It was two big fire trucks, a fire truck with the ladder, like the really huge one, and then like the normal fire truck, and then two ambulances. When I walked up, I got as close to maybe about 4 houses away from the scene itself. There was a lot of deputies going in and out of a house. And I thought maybe they were like raiding the house, because there's like all the lights were on, and it's like 2 o'clock in the morning, and they were just going in and out of the house, a lot of them. And I tried to get as close as possible, and like this was during COVID, so like it was in the beginning of that. So when the cop had seen me, he was like, stand back, put a mask, stand back. And I had told him, like, hey, my son is Joseph. He hasn't came home yet. He was walking home. He's mentally ill. You know, from my understanding right now, he was talking to himself, like, what happened here? And because I don't know how to explain it, but it's kind of like you don't think it's your kid, but yet you need to like ask. So the guy, the cop, and he, I believe he was a captain, he was a bald black guy, and the captain is bald and black. And he told me that there was a bad fight. That there was, that I need to stand back, that there was a bad fight. And I was like, okay, a fight. And so like I'm thinking now, like, is that why they're raiding the house? Like, is that why they're all like, you know, you're trying to put a story together of what you're seeing. And it was very quiet on the street. There wasn't really noise. I mean, there was talking from deputies and sergeants and whatnot. And there were a group of deputies were huddled. And I there was three firemen that were in a different circle that were closer to the edge of the sidewalk. And one would kneel down. And he didn't stay down very long, but he kneeled down and I couldn't see like why he would kneel down. At that time I didn't realize why he was kneeling down. So later on to find out like that was my son. Like, and he was, I guess, checking his for a heartbeat through his neck or a pulse. But like for 45 minutes as he did that, like I didn't know that that was Joseph because Joseph was completely quiet. So during these 45, the longest 45 minutes of my life here, the captain came back and he was asking me more about my son. And then he didn't like confirm, or he didn't, it was just like, what was your kid's name again? Like, you said you were looking for your son. And I was like, his name's Joseph Perez. And then like he'd go away, right? He'd walk away. And all of a sudden I seen deputies put a guy on a gurney. And I thought that was kind of weird, right? Because I've never seen deputies put hands on somebody that's injured to put him on a gurney. So, and he didn't have his, like, he didn't have a uniform on. Like, he didn't, he looked like a white t-shirt and a white man. And I had asked, like, wait a minute, like, if there is a bad fight and that's one of the guys, where's the other guy? Like, where's the other guy with this bad fight? And he's like, ma'am, you need to stand back. You just need to stand back. You're getting too close. And I just like remember seeing maybe about five to six officers trying to put this deputy on a gurney, and then that ambulance left. And there was another ambulance there, and they were just standing there. They weren't, they were just standing by their truck. And I remember it's all of a sudden Joseph started screaming, and he was screaming, why did you do this to me? Why did you do this to me? And he would get quiet, like if he would just like it would get silent. And then he would say, mom, mom, like he was screaming for me. And then he asked, let me go home with you.
And then they would get quiet. Yeah, it would just get real quiet. And then I remember, and I guess he was a sergeant. Come to find out now, they had he came the captain came back to me and confirmed that was Joseph. I mean, like, obviously I already knew because Joseph started screaming. But now the captain had said that Joseph was involved in a burglary. And so, like, their narrative changed, right? And at that time he had said, well, was your, before he said about the burglary, he said, well, was your son a drug addict? Was your son in jail? Like, oh, he's been convicted before. Like, he asked all the questions where now I know it's him. It was them getting, painting their narrative. Like, it's like part of those interrogations where they got as much information from me, which I thought I was helping, but all I did was help create a narrative for them. Because, like I said, Joseph had just got released. So I was like, yeah, he's been in jail. He just got out of jail. And like, I fit this narrative for them. And after, like, we're still there, but like, after that they confirmed to me that from them that, yeah, that was Joseph. The sergeant, another, like, his name was Polito. He had went to the firemen and they all looked at me, like, turned around and looked at me. And I don't know what was said, but that sergeant grabbed a sterilized water bottle and then he called out names. And the like three deputies followed him to the inside that home, like in the gate. And then they all came out with napkins, like if they washed their hands, like that with that water bottle, because they all had napkins in their hands. And then they all left. And after they left, they put on a lot of the lights, the sirens, not the noise, but the lights. And I couldn't see now. Right, I couldn't see what I was seeing before, and they blocked me out to where all of a sudden I didn't see them put Joseph on a gurney because of the lights, and then all of a sudden when the lights left, the street was empty, and they didn't tell me where Joseph was at. Like, I had to look for him. Like, I just went to the closest hospital, and there he was in the hospital. And when I got to the hospital, I was trying to tell him, like, you know, he was mentally ill, and what I heard from what I heard outside of the hospital, like from them talking in inside, like they wouldn't let me in on top of the COVID, and they wouldn't let me in, period. Like, because they said he was like under their custody now. But I had heard them tell the doctor that Joseph stole a car and he was like in a car accident. That was not true. That wasn't true at all. And they kept him there for about 3 to 4 hours. And I tried to get in the hospital like many of times and they always kicked me out. And about 7:30 in the morning, they wheeled him outside, and he was obviously like, you know, his eye was like bulging out of his face, and I was trying to say Joseph, and it looked like he was trying to focus in on me, but like couldn't, and they took him to jail. And they took him to jail. And they had charged him in the beginning, I believe it was five resisting arrest from five different officers. And they put him like in high power, like for like 10 months. And his injuries, they ended up putting a 17 staples to his scalp. They didn't use any anesthesia. It was like five large lacerations. And then they put some skin adhesive to other parts of his scalp. And then they put 19 stitches to his face and his ears. And according to like the medical records, from the hospital, they said that they didn't give him a scan because he had handcuffs on, so he wasn't allowed to get a scan, like a brain scan or a CAT scan due to the handcuffs. So like he never got like the proper, you know. I'm sure if they would have scanned him, he wouldn't have been able to leave, right? But they would have had to have kept him to help get better.
And it's the example of what you and your family faced during this is the stories that people need to be hearing about. And there was a really good write-up on you from the Los Angeles Times, and this picture is absolutely stunning that they used. And it's actually going to be the picture that everybody can see on your podcast episode as well, because I think it's very what it kind of sets the tone to the story too. And in 5 years, you're still fighting for justice and to hold the department accountable for misconduct. And there's been like that ongoing legal battle. And what exactly happened to Joseph? And it is so deeply devastating that in 2025, 5 years later, still no closer than you were 5 years ago, But I know you shared your story dozens of times, and it's getting out there, which I'm really glad to see. Now, per this article, according to the report, deputies from the industry station stopped Joseph, who was 27 at that time, on suspicion of breaking into a car. He punched and kicked them multiple times. The document states three deputies injured their hands, and a fourth broke his leg, falling off a curb. Six deputies punched Joseph and deployed various holds and takedowns before he was arrested and charged with 5 counts of resisting an executive officer, court records show. But the entire pages of the department's use of force report are blacked out, leaving you and members of the Civilian Oversight Commission wondering what details are being kept secret. County oversight officials issued three subpoenas in February for cases under scrutiny, including one seeking unredacted copy of the Perez file. The county council's office has resisted, arguing the files should remain confidential, and the LA County Sheriff's Department has declined to hand them over. Looking at the pictures of Joseph from that time, I feel like something just like literally took the wind out of my body. And I cannot imagine what it was like for you to see that. I know what it's like for me, and I wasn't there. I just see pictures, but I've also watched videos, and you send me videos, you sent me pictures, and this is deeply, deeply devastating. This is deeply devastating. So again, I want to acknowledge the fact about how incredibly hard it is for you to share this over and over again, but I also know that it's also, in a sense, also feeling as well about getting what happened to Joseph and helping others understand how complex this issue truly is. So again, I want to say thank you for that. And I want to kind of like jump in a little bit because there's been some recent action from Governor Gavin Newsom. And he recently signed two bills that your son Joseph was, like a big inspiration behind, which was AB 847, which would stop share or which will now stop sheriff departments from hiding misconduct from oversight bodies, also known as AB 847. And then the other one is AB 572. So I think that these are incredible bills. So can you walk us through, your advocacy of traveling to the state capitol, talking with legislatures, talking with, getting these bills passed and the inspiration behind that?
Well, that's all like the commission, the Sheriff's Civilian Oversight Commission. Like, I am so grateful for them, listening to me, I guess. I think you go into these meetings and you sound repetitive, right? Like, you're saying the same, like, how many times can I tell them, like, they beat Joseph and this, there's something wrong, right? Like, and I didn't give up, and they just, like, listened. And I think what happened was they were able to file, like, for those records. I'm trying to get records so they can look into it. And they got the same information that anybody would get on the street. Like, there were redacted records. And that shows, like, if the sheriff's civilian oversight is there to be oversight, and how are they supposed to be effective if they can't even get records? If they're getting the same records that we, the people, are getting. And it was Joseph's case and two other cases that were consistent in this. And they asked me if they can use Joseph's case as part of, like, like the example, like, one of the faces of it, like, because how can they not get these records? And that's how that came about with the AB 847. And Bonner went to Sacramento, and he's the one that was, like, say Joseph's name out there and spoke to the senators and to the people out there, which is amazing, and I'm completely grateful for that.
And you've been, going to, like, these meetings with, like, other families that you've connected with as well. And, what has that been like being around people who just get it? Like, they understand the complexity of these issues. And being around other people who just get it, what's been, like, your experience, like, connecting with other families? And then also been your experience about, like, social media, like, advocacy as well?
Everybody has, like, a different story. There's not really a lot of stories that I hear like Joseph's. What I've like noticed, though, is that the families that their loved ones were killed, I noticed that they have, like, 30 pages or 40 pages of records, whereas Joseph had 86. I believe that, like, has something to do with, like, a cover-up. There was Joseph stood alive, so they had to, like, get more of their story together. And overall, it's, like, a difficult process with the dynamics of families. I'm always here to support all families, but at the same time, I feel that a lot of survivors don't speak up. Like Emmett Brock, he was part of the subpoenas as well, and he was lucky to get his, not lucky, but I mean, it was lucky that it was recorded and it wasn't just his word against theirs. Like, cameras were able to speak for itself, and he was able to get justice, whereas Joseph, they said there's no cameras, there was no this, there was no that, no street cameras, no nothing. And so, yeah, I'm sorry, I don't think I answered your question right now.
No, you're perfectly fine. And then what has been, like, your social media, like, advocacy been like for you? Because, you run the page Justice for Joseph, and what has been, like, that experience been like for you on social media? What are you seeing in your comments? What are you seeing? And, like, people have been people been reaching out to you? What's been your experience with, like, social media outreach?
So in the beginning of this, I had created an account on TikTok, and I had put Joseph's video of him getting rolled out of the hospital. And that kind of, like, blew up, right? And there was a lot of negative comments, a lot of negative, where, like, I would break out in hives, because it's it's hard to, people can be so cruel. People can be so cruel. And I know now, like, there's a lot of people out there that are paid just to be cruel, you know? But at the time, I was very, very vulnerable and didn't know how to handle it. Like, didn't know to just ignore it. And like, I would literally break out in hives and cry and like try to respond back. And but it just, it did a lot. It did a lot. A lot of draining happened. And so I stopped using that media. And it wasn't until recently, about a year ago, on Instagram, I decided to make a Justice for Joseph page. And what I've learned to do is post what I'm going to post and just don't look back. Don't look back. Just, you know, or if I'm going to respond to anybody, just stick with the positivity, you know, and just don't read into the negativity. Because, like I said, the people can be so cruel. But I also feel with Joseph's story, it gets out there, you know, it does get out there. People are seen, people are watching, and that truly is amazing. That truly is amazing that people that I don't know are following Joseph's story and being supportive, of course.
And what is next for you? You know, what these bills are done, these bills are signed into action. And I know you're going to continue showing up. I know you're going to continue, you know, being vocal and ensuring that Joseph's story continues to get out there. What are you hoping that people understand about this complexity of police brutality and mental health? And, you know, what's next for you? Where are you headed? What's next in store for you?
Right now, what's next is law school. Law school is next. But I'm just gonna keep fighting and getting Joseph's word out no matter what. No matter what. I know recently it was like really awesome. One of my professors had read the article of the AB 847 passing, and she's a research professor, and she was very helpful. And because sometimes you don't know like who's going to be receptive to police injustice, right? And she ended up helping like set me up with another interview for the school, you know, where the Cal Poly Pomona wrote an article on Joseph. And that's amazing. And like to get that out there, and that's just amazing in itself. And I really hope that that will help other students. You know, because not everyone, people don't like to talk about being beaten like that. It does, it is not something where it just comes up in conversation. Usually it's, you know, they killed my loved one. You know, like, so where I see myself in the next year or two is helping other families like myself, helping other survivors and giving them a voice, being their voice when they need it, helping vulnerable families at least give them resources or point them in the right direction.
You know, whenever I asked the question of what's next for you, I was not expecting to hear you say going to law school. But I'm so excited, you know, and let's kind of like dive into that for a little bit. So, what, obviously, you have a lot more to fight for now. But whenever you were a child, what did you see yourself doing? Like, did you see yourself being an attorney? Did you see yourself being a police officer? You know, every child has like this vision. Right. And oftentimes that vision is destroyed by trauma or by, you know,
Life.
something or like, yeah, like you said, like life.
Yeah.
But what inspired you to go to law school and what do you hope to accomplish with that? Because, first of all, that's incredible. You know, that's super exciting. And I know you're in school right now too. So just walk us through like that journey, like your educational journey aspect too.
What ended up happening was that in the beginning of all of this, I would go to court for Joseph, obviously, and I wasn't getting anywhere. Like, I wasn't getting help. I didn't feel, the public defenders were helping. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know there was a difference between a civil lawsuit and a criminal case. And Joseph ended up being in jail for 2 years. And the same month that he got out, we found out that the seventh officer, Paul Saldana, was a school resource officer at my daughter's high school. And, that's devastating in itself, because Paul Saldana was a seventh officer. He came in at punch 107 and stopped at 121. And he's a school resource officer at my daughter's school, where I literally have to drop her off at school knowing that my son's perpetrator is there. And I didn't. Like, I would go to the school district and the school, obviously, and tell them I would fight with the principals. They didn't see nothing wrong with it. And I would take pictures of Joseph and I would stand in front of the school and with my sign. And like, I didn't feel like I was being heard, like I still had to drop my daughter off and nothing was happening. And I got me and Joseph, me and Joseph, and my daughter made a bunch of flyers, right? And we wrote on them, and even Joseph wrote on one, and he's like, "I thought I was gonna die. He did this to me." And like, we made hundreds of them, and we like taped them all over the school, like all over the poles, like in front right there. And like, I still felt like yeah, that's like a little win, but like, I still felt like I wasn't doing anything. And I said, "How can I screw this guy up? Like, how can I can't just." Like, I can't be physical with him, right? And the school district was like, they said they were trying to help, but like, I really didn't feel it. Or they weren't moving fast enough, I guess, for me. And so like, I started thinking using my little brain here, and I was like, file a restraining order. File a restraining order. That's gonna at least prevent him for a couple of months, like without a gun, right? It's gonna like stop them. It's gonna screw them up one way or the other, right? Maybe not permanently, but it's gonna do something. So we filed a restraining order, and it took like 4 months. They didn't give it to me, right? Of course, they weren't gonna give it to me, but nonetheless, like he couldn't carry his gun during those months. And I started the civilian oversight came in, and they helped me. And he ended up losing his not losing it, but his contract had to end after all of this, right? So June 1st, he ended up not being as a school resource deputy. And like, through all of this corruption, and like, I don't understand how this man that beat my son the way he did was put into a school with 2,000 children and then put in with my daughter there. And the crazy thing about it is that the school district had called me into a meeting one time, and there was a security guard there, and they had said, "We're sorry this is happening. We understand. We want the best for your daughter, but we're gonna give her this security, this guy right here, and she's always gonna be in arm's reach to your daughter. And if Saldana is walking across and she doesn't feel comfortable, she could just look at the security, and she's gonna be okay." Like, he'll walk with her if she feels if she doesn't feel right. Like, and I said, "Okay, cool. Like, that sounds great. Like, we're in this meeting." And of course, you go home and you process it, right? You drive, you process. And I was like, "Wait a minute. They don't think she's safe either. Like, what the hell? Like, why wouldn't they just remove this guy like immediately instead of giving her the security guard, right?" So, like, after injustice and after another injustice, and I felt like I'm not getting anywhere. And I would go to Joseph would go to Pomona Court, so I would drive to Pomona, and I would drive by Mount Si. And but I don't know what happened. Like, I literally like rolled into the parking lot, and I was like, "I need to go to school. I need an education. Like, there's no way of winning any of these people if I don't get an education." So I enrolled. I started like literally like in 2 months after I enrolled. And I enrolled into the paralegal studies for an associate's. And then from there, I added an administrative justice And then I added social justice. And so I walked away from Mount SAC in 3 years with three different degrees. And then I enrolled into Cal Poly at the university. And now I'm a criminology major. And from here, like, I'm looking at Laverne. Like, that's the next goal is law school. You know? And it's bittersweet because at the end of this, like, this would have never started if this didn't happen to Joseph. You know, so it's very bittersweet. And not just Joseph, like his sister as well. And I feel like without this education behind me, I'm not going to be able to help other families. So it's very, very important to me. You know, very, it's like in my heart and my soul now, you know? And even Joseph, he tells me, like, Mom, I'm proud of you. Like, I'm really proud of you. Did you go to school today? Like, he calls, you know, like twice a week. And he's like, did you go to school today? Did you learn it? Like, you know, he's just, and I always tell him, like, I'm so, like, grateful. Like, this is because of you. Like, this is, and it's bittersweet. It's bittersweet. And he always just tells me, like, he's proud of me. And he thanks me all the time for, like, sticking up for him and speaking up.
You know, I have to echo that and say that I'm incredibly proud of you too. You know, I've known you for the last couple months, and this episode has been in the works for the last couple months because there's been some like different things going on my end and then your end, and you know, just different things that just continue to happen. But I'm really glad that we've had the opportunity to sit down and have this conversation, because every single day you were speaking up and advocating against police brutality, not only for your son, but also for the other families who have also faced this. And we know that the system is far beyond just screwed. We know that, for a lack of a better term. If I said what I actually wanted to say, I probably wouldn't have a podcast anymore or a social media account or anything else. And certain people would be knocking on my doorstep. But anyway, I'm just really excited, you know, to continue watching your journey and, you know, continue to uplift your voice and your story. And for those out there who are listening, recognize how complex this issue is and know that this is not just a singular instance of this happening in the United States and across the globe too, not just here, but everywhere. And no matter where you are in your communities, this happens every single day in every single community, regardless how big or how small it is, regardless if it's rural or suburban, big city, small city, Democrat, Republican, etc. This is all across the board. So where is Joseph now? What is he doing now? Where is he at? And, you know, how is he doing?
Joseph's incarcerated as of now. And he's waiting to get into a program, you know, and it's sad to say that, you know, once you're arrested for resisting arrest or supposedly being violent with officers, like, that's going to stick with you no matter what, you know? And then he's working on just himself right now. We're just trying to get him into, trying to get him the help that he needs.
Absolutely. How long has he been incarcerated?
He's been incarcerated for a couple months now.
Wow.
Yeah, he has court next week. Hopefully they get him into a good program, somewhere that fits him, because he's been through so much. He's been through so much trauma, and his mental status, obviously, from when he was a child. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've been there since day one. And I know you're not going to leave his side. And I know that you are an inspiration to so many families who are also facing this. And part of the mission of the Rise of Justice Movement is not just a mission. Or not just a movement, but it's also a mission. And a mission to help amplify these stories that don't reach the headlines. And, you know, you have an open invite. You know, anytime you have anything else to share on this case or any other aspect, of anything, feel free to reach out. You already know that. You already know the direct way to reach me. And, I appreciate you coming on the podcast. Is there anything else you would like to share with anybody who may be listening today?
Yeah, if anybody is going through something similar like this, don't give up no matter what. Like, I know it's intimidating because these are like law enforcement you're going up against, but just don't give up. Keep speaking and just keep
Yes.
speaking.
Yes, absolutely.
Even
Vanessa.
when you feel repetitive, even
Yeah.
when you're saying the same thing, say it again. Say it again.
Yes, 100%. Absolutely. And you please take care of yourself. I'm so excited to continue following you and uplifting your journey. And please take care of yourself and feel free to reach out anytime you need, okay?
Thank you so much.
Of course.